Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist at the American Centrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Because news is breaking so fast, let me just note that we are recording on the 3rd of March at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 4 p.m. Central European Time. Over the past several weeks, many listeners of the show, both in Europe and the U.S., have expressed their concerns about the status of the Ukraine war, the reliability of the NATO alliance, and the future of the transatlantic relationship. Basically, they've been asking me, is it time to hit the panic button? Well, I can't answer that question for you, but I'm hoping my guest can. Indeed, few people have as much knowledge and have acquired as much experience about NATO and U.S. foreign policy as my special guest today, Ambassador Douglas Lute. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Good to be with you.
Ambassador Lute was born in Michigan City, Indiana. He attended West Point and had a distinguished career in the U.S. Army, retiring as a lieutenant general. From 2007 to 2013, he was deputy national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan, first for President Bush and then for President Obama. And from 2013 to 2017, he was U.S. ambassador to NATO. Over the last several weeks, Ambassador Lute has been on a speaking tour of Germany, during which time a lot of foreign policy news was made. On the 14th of February, at the Munich Security Conference, Vice President J.D. Vance stunned the European security community by suggesting that the biggest threat to Europe was not Russian aggression in Ukraine, but a deficiency of democratic values within Europe. On February 23rd, the German people went to the polls and elected a new government, which will be led by Friedrich Merz of the center-right Christian Democrats. Merz has always been an ultra-strong supporter of the U.S., but even he has expressed serious concerns about the extent to which Europe can rely on the United States, stating that Europe needs to develop strategic independence. And just a couple of days ago, the European security community, again, was further shaken by the chaotic meeting between President Trump and President Zelensky at the White House, and the consequences of that kerfuffle are yet to be fully understood. So it's been a busy couple weeks, and maybe Ambassador Lute, maybe we can just start with you. You've been in Germany for the past couple of weeks. You were at the Munich Security Conference. Sort of what was the atmosphere like when you were there, and maybe what were some of your big takeaways from your tour of Germany?
Well, thanks to you and to the Centrum for bringing us together this morning, at least this morning, Washington time. I think the seminal event at Munich this year will be the Vance speech, which you've already previewed. A couple interesting things about that. So I noticed on the day before his speech, that Vice President Vance visited the Dachau memorial site. And I thought to myself, you know, this is really a smart move, because if you're going to address the Munich Security Conference the next day, what better prelude than to pay respects to the victims of the last time Europe was dominated by an authoritarian dictatorship and suffered the tragedies of World War II and the Holocaust and all that. And I thought, you know, he's setting himself up perfectly for the next day when he addresses the 200 or 300 people in the main hall of the Bayerischerhof in Munich during the security conference. But he didn't go there at all. On Thursday, visits Dachau. On Friday, he comes to the security conference and essentially scolds and, I think, shows disrespect to mainly European audience. And as you said, he focused not on the obvious threat to Europe today, which is Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine just 3 years ago, almost precisely 3 years ago at the time, but rather on this notion that the greatest threat to Europe is internal and a threat to things like election interference, suppressing freedom of the press, and expression among European voters. This struck me as bizarre. First of all, coming from someone from this particular American administration, I mean, how does this administration, perhaps among many recent administrations, lecture anybody on rule of law, given the indelible images of January 6th, when clearly there was an attempt to overthrow our election process. How does anybody in this administration talk about suppression of free press when this White House has done exactly that with U.S. press outlets who have not walked the fine line with regard to policy decisions like renaming the Gulf of Mexico, of all things, right? There's been retribution, and these press outlets have been excluded from even the White House. So I thought it was not only wrong on substance, but absolutely wrong on tone. And it very much set the stage for the rest of the conference. You know, some people were talking about two previous Munich events, to which this one in 2025 might be added as historic. One was obviously Munich 1938, and then the second was Munich Security Conference 2007, when Putin last invited, and he sort of laid out his campaign plan for resurrecting, for reconstructing the Soviet Union and the Soviet spheres of influence around the Soviet Union's periphery. And you know, that was in 2007, a sort of a seminal moment for the Munich Security Conference. And quite candidly, it caught everyone by surprise, but I'm not sure we really paid attention. So I'm hopeful this year in 2025 that we're really paying attention to what J.D. Vance said, because it is perhaps an indicator, a signpost of a very important strategic shift between America and Europe.
Great. And I want to talk about that strategic shift, but if I can get you just to stick with the general atmosphere that you encountered in Germany as you then went to different places and spoke to average German people around the country.
Well, when the security conference breaks down, right, and you're able to sort of walk out of the security bubble around the Bayerischer Hof in Munich, what I encountered in a series of German cities was bewilderment and almost disbelief that an American administration could so quickly, in its first 30 days, do such, if nothing else, reputational harm to the transatlantic relationship, which of course has stood up for, well, if you count it by NATO's history, you know, soon 76 years, and has seen other tough periods, Andy. You know, it saw the Suez Crisis in 56. Remember the drama around the Vietnam War. Remember the Euro missile crisis later. Remember the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So it's not as though these 76 years of NATO history or transatlantic history has been all smooth sailing and has been all nothing but camaraderie. There have been challenges. But this feels more fundamental, because this shift over the first month plus of the Trump administration seems to suggest that the very foundation, the very fundamental connections between the United States and Europe, from my experience, most prominently NATO, may be at risk.
Yeah, and I might just add the problem with Turkey getting Russian air defense systems.
Yeah, the F-400, right?
And then, of course, Hungary not necessarily showing itself to be the greatest of U.S. allies.
Right.
And there's also been plenty of anti-Americanism in Europe for all of these years, and it comes and goes. I've certainly lived through at least three of these waves, and this will be my fourth, so I have a thick skin.
So how does this feel to you? Does this feel, you know, sort of substantively different than the previous dips in...
It reminds me a lot of 2003, when I was a graduate student in Britain and seeing and feeling the extent of anti-Americanism about the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
And that was pretty defining, I think, in my career personally and my understanding of politics. But, you know, it just, I just, like, as an American living in Europe, sometimes it gets exhausting trying to remind people of the long and complex history of the United States and that we make mistakes. But when we do it, it's mostly due to arrogance or stupidity, not because we actually want to destroy things. You know, we try to say we're doing good and maybe we make a mistake, overstretch. But this time, for me, it does feel like there's sort of this malign intent really to intentionally screw things up. And that's something that I've never felt before. When I've been defending the U.S., I'm always like, I don't think this is intentional. We've gone astray. But this time it seems pretty much mit Absicht, as they say in German. And now I can't remember the word in English.
Yeah, I think.
Intentional.
Yeah, intentionally or fundamental, you know, intentional, deliberate, right? And fundamental to what has, I think, overall, given the puts and takes, right, given the ups and downs, has served not only Europe, but, and here's the point that's missed by this administration, has served America well over those 76 years. So in a movement towards make America great again and America first, I think there's a very elementary point that's being missed, which is that it's America who perhaps benefited most of all from the rules of the road, the international order that was set up in the wake of World War II. I mean, to this day, we have the largest economy. To this day, we have the largest military. To this day, we have the greatest strategic advantage over our two main international competitors, China and Russia, because of our alliance structures. So this isn't a matter of America being ripped off or taken advantage of. Or alternatively, this is not a matter of American charity or altruism towards others, right? This is fundamentally an America first project, and America has benefited from it. Now, others have as well. But I think we miss the point that the existing world order and institutions like the UN and NATO, World Bank, IMF, WTO, and so forth, fundamentally have also served America.
You've mentioned so many important points there. I just want to pause and kind of split them apart so our audience, who doesn't necessarily study this all the time, gets a better sense of what we're talking about here. So we can think about U.S. foreign policy since World War II, maybe having four pillars. I'm just going to net out some basics for our audience. You mentioned military alliances. So the first thing you learn in International Relations 101 is that military alliances are good for the United States because allied countries are force multipliers when the U.S. decides to use military force. It's good to have bases around the world. It's good to have friends. It's good to have allies. The second key principle, as you mentioned, is trade agreements. Trade agreements with allies are good. It brings U.S. products to the world market. It allows international trade. And just to add the other point about American power economically is it ensures the primacy of the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency, which happens through free trade. Thirdly, you mentioned international organizations, the UN, World Health Organization, IMF, World Bank. They encourage order and stability, which is good for the U.S. economy. It reduces the need for U.S. military force to stabilize failed states. And again, these are imperfect institutions. Yes, sure. But they are still forces of order. And then fourthly, U.S. development aid. This is good for the U.S. because it expands American influence. It's a more difficult argument to make. Influence, how do you measure that? But when you think of the lack of U.S. influence, then you have to think of power vacuums. If the U.S. isn't stepping in to help poor African countries, who is going to take their place? ISIS, jihadists, Iran, China, Russia, certainly bad actors then come in. So, I mean, those are the four things we learn on day one of international relations.
Right.
And Ambassador Lute, it seems like each of these four, we might need to start revising. Do we need to start rethinking this? I mean, you said we're getting into a new phase. There's a shift. how do we think of these four principles then? I mean, do we forget the idea that military alliances are good? How does that world work for the U.S.?
Well, I think there is a fundamental shift underway. Let me just, because I'm closest to the first of your four,
yeah,
the military alliance thing, let me just start there. You know, it's important for Americans to remember that Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, signed all the way back in 1949, right? So it's about to be 76 years old. Article 5, the article that says an attack on one shall be considered as an attack on all the others. So today, among the 32, right? It's only been activated once in 76 years. And that's when America needed its allies in the wake of the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Americans tend to forget that. But when America needed allies, when we needed to figure out who attacked us, how we could respond, the steps we needed to protect ourselves further, because it wasn't clear that this was a one-off bad day on 9/11, and the implications for 9/11 on our allies, it was our allies who came to American assistance and activated Article 5 and then deployed to Afghanistan with us, suffered one-third of the total casualties over 20 years in Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm a little resentful that many of my countrymen take that for granted. And we have a sort of a short memory span that, if anything, 9/11 and the 20 years that followed exemplify why we need allies. So I was struck with that memory as you were laying out the construct. Look, I agree with the four basic pillars, which are the instruments of foreign policy, right? So security, trade, development, and
international.
And international, right. So I accept that. The world, however, behind those pillars, the backdrop is shifting, I believe, today. And let me just try to unpack this for our listeners, right? So in the wake of World War II, for about 40 years, we were clearly in what international relations scholars term the bipolar world, right? So two major power centers, two major global poles, the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies. And most of international relations from 45 to sort of 1990 hinged on this bipolar competition. And it was everything from nuclear deterrence at the very top, all the way through competition for resources in Africa, you know, and everything in between. So this was very much a bipolar world. With the fall of the Berlin Wall in 89, the reunification of Germany a year later, and then in the end of 91, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, we moved into a new global structure where the U.S. and its allies formed the only pole in the organizational arrangement of the world. And look, this wasn't all a great time. I mean, this featured the breakup of Yugoslavia and the resultant Balkan Wars. It featured 9/11 in 2001. It featured 2 years later, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and so forth. So there were challenges in this unipolar period. I mark the end of the unipolar period, for those who are really paying close attention, as 2014. When Putin, for the first time since World War II, we had a nuclear superpower invade a smaller neighbor and seize sovereign territory with the seizing of Crimea, the illegal annexation of Crimea, the destabilizing of the Donbas region in Ukraine, and so forth, in very clear defiance of two of the organizing principles of the world order. And these are the two that are cited in the second article of the UN Charter, right? And they are national sovereignty, so the right of nations to choose their own path. They get to choose their own leaders. They get to write their own constitution. They get to choose their membership, that nation's membership in international organizations. So choosing to apply to be in the European Union, for example, or choosing to aspire to NATO membership. These are national choices, not to be dictated from outside the nation. And then the second principle is that borders count, territorial integrity. But with Putin's invasion in 2014, both of these rules were violated by a permanent member of the Security Council, which I think marks a fundamental shift in world order. Clearly, in the 8 years from 2014 to 2022, this shift has become much more obvious now. I mean, with the full-scale invasion in 2022 by Russia of Ukraine, I think it's now undeniable that we're in a shifting, changing, dynamic transition in the world order. And most, I think, serious observers of this transition believe that we're moving to something that doesn't look like bipolarism. It doesn't look like unipolar. It looks like multipolar. So the structure of the international system is moving to several power centers. Now, much of what we see in the news day to day, coming out of the Munich Security Conference and even today's podcast and recent events since Munich, I think are indicators that this shift is underway. And the fundamental question will be, who will the poles be in a multipolar world? So it's clear that the U.S. will remain a pole. And this is because of hard power, military power, soft power, economic power, and so forth. It's also clear, however, that China will be a pole, largely based on economic manufacturing capability and, at least for now, political cohesion as dictated by the Communist Party in China and so forth. So China's going to be a pole. And by the way, it's a rising hard power as well by way of militarization. I think the war in Ukraine, the short story there is Putin is saying, what about me? Will the Russian Federation, or will the Russian Federation expanded be one of these poles in this unipolar world? Or will it fade into irrelevance? And Putin's essentially fighting for relevance, and he's fighting for a position in the new world order. Most recently, with the divides evident between this American administration and our European allies, I think Europe is coming to grips with the fact, or at least the appreciation that Europe may need to be an independent pole and break from the decades-long standing, that it would just be aligned with the U.S. So the Western pole, which has predominated since World War II, may be splitting into two, with America remaining as a pole and the Europeans trying to figure out whether they can muster the power. And for Europe, this is seen in the right after the Munich Security Conference, the emergency meeting hosted by President Macron in Paris. More recently, this weekend, another emergency meeting of some 15 European leaders in the wake of the Trump-Zelensky Oval Office drama last Friday. So these meetings reflect that Europe appreciates that now is the time that it's got to decide whether it's going to be a pole or it's going to slip into irrelevance. And for Europe, the good news is it has the economic strength to be a global pole, right? It has mustered, but not always, the political coherence by way of the European Union to be a pole. But the big gap is in hard power. Can Europe muster, can it generate sufficient hard power, which is still an essential element if an entity like Europe, United Europe, founded on the European Union, wishes to be one of the poles in this new structure? So look, that's a long-winded answer to say we are in a period of transition. And while China and the U.S. are clearly going to be poles in this new structure, Russia is saying, what about me? And the Europeans are considering what it would take to be independent of the United States.
And independence, I think, with the EU does not necessarily mean not being allies. It just means independence. It means being able to choose without coercion, which critical issues are critical issues for them and which are for the U.S. I mean, right. I'm resistant of thinking that these poles have to be opposed. Even China and Russia might grow closer.
Right.
The U.S. and Europe might grow further apart, but still be close allies when push comes to shove. But who knows?
No, I agree. In fact, the two, what I consider the two obvious poles, the U.S. and China, will probably have a blend of competition and cooperation. I mean, there are things that clearly U.S. and China will need to cooperate on, things like climate, global health, and they both have an interest in open trade. So I agree. The polls don't suggest that these are going to be, that these entities will be at war with one another. They will, and I think in almost each case, in every case, there'll be a blend of both cooperation and competition.
Good. When you were talking about these four polls, EU, US, China, and Russia, interestingly enough, no global organizations were in that list. So as I was talking about these four important concepts in Foreign Policy 101, we have military alliances, trade agreements, international organizations like the UN, and then development aid. So number three was international organizations. You know, part of the post-World War II world that the U.S. created, the primacy of international organizations was seen to be also in the U.S. interest.
Right.
The World Bank, the IMF are in the U.S. interest. It guarantees global trade, fair trade. Again, not perfect, but they do their best. The UN, definitely not a perfect institution, but it helps to moderate conflicts, gets people talking. The World Health Organization, you know, again, maybe not a perfect organization, but having disease detectives in Africa or Asia to monitor new diseases and potential pandemics is really important. So we're talking about the world shifting. Is there a place for international organizations, given that the U.S. administration currently doesn't think that international organizations are all that important? Can someone else, can the other poles take on the mantle of leadership of these international organizations? Or are we done with an international organization period of time?
Well, I suppose I'm a victim of being 72 years old and experiencing the last, you know, at least sort of paying attention the last 40 or 50 years. And it's difficult for me to imagine a wholesale replacement of the kinds of international institutions that you outline, Andy. I do think, however, that there's something to the sense that these organizations have to adapt or die. So let me just take a few examples. Look, NATO today on the security front is not the NATO of 1949. It's dramatically changed. NATO today is not even the NATO of 2014. I mean, NATO now has added Finland and Sweden. It's adapted, right? NATO today has NATO troops where they never were before 2014, all along the eastern flank, running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. NATO today, after 20 or 25 years of a vacation on defense spending, now has had 10 consecutive years of real increased defense investment. Now, it's interesting that, you know, sometimes as a former NATO ambassador, I take the question, well, who's responsible for that adaptation? You know, was it Biden? Was it Obama under whom I served, but some of the adaptations began, right, to include the spending increases? Was it Trump who yelled at allies publicly to spend more, or was it Biden? And I said, you've got it wrong all three times. It was Putin who's responsible for most of the adaptations of the last 10 years in NATO. But the point is, more to your central point, NATO has adapted. This is not our grandfather's NATO or father's NATO. The question will be, can the other institutions likewise adapt to changing environment? So look at the UN. The permanent members of the Security Council have not changed since 1945. The prominence, the significance of the Security Council has not changed relative to the General Assembly, so the other major political body in the UN, right? Even though you now have a permanent member of the Security Council who has violated the charter in very obvious terms and is led by an indicted war criminal. So if the UN, in the face of that kind of challenge, those kinds of challenges, cannot find its way to adapt, it will, I think, inevitably continue to drift towards irrelevance. So just using NATO as maybe a positive example and the UN as, you know, on the other side of the ledger, I think my key observation would be adapt or die. And it very much rests with these institutions and the leaders of these institutions, the national leaders of these institutions, to figure out which it will be. It is difficult, however, to imagine that the world's a better place without them. I mean, to go back to the World Health Organization. So who's going to do this? I mean, if it's not the World Health Organization that detects, shares information, shares potential responses across levels, the ability of different nation states to respond, then everybody's going to suffer. And there's no obvious replacement. So for those who argue these institutions are out of date, they don't serve us, we're getting ripped off, we're being taken advantage of, you know, there's an element there. But then the question is, so what's next? And I would argue that what's next needs to be a concerted effort, a concerted international effort, perhaps among these emerging poles, right? These in the emerging power structure, to figure out the appropriate adaptations so that these institutions can continue to serve the common good and essentially not throw the baby out with the bathwater, right?
Yeah, well, thinking about then the institutions adapting or dying, and I really like that phrase. Getting back to Europe, do you think the EU is undergoing a process of adapting?
I think the EU, as indicated by these emergency, just this in the last weeks, right? The series of emergency meetings trying to cope with the stimuli coming out of Washington is absolutely doing a sort of introspection, looking in the mirror and asking itself, okay, if we cannot rely on the United States, then what's it going to be? And I think so far the answer has been a resounding, we're going to step up. Europe will step up and meet this challenge. And the significance of this is great because today they have a challenge not only to the east with Putin's obvious invasion of Ukraine in violation of the international rules of the road, right? But increasingly they face a two-front challenge because they have a challenge in Washington as well. I'm encouraged, though, when you see, what, last Friday, you see the Zelensky, Trump, Vance, you know, sort of reality TV drama in the Oval Office, right? And the European leaders respond immediately with the London-hosted, UK-hosted meetings that essentially say, and that welcome Zelensky to London, right? And commit to him increased military support and continued political support as a body, as Europe. I think that's very significant. Now, the challenge will be that Europe's now got to deliver. And it's got to deliver on that hard power commitment to assist Zelensky. And it's got to assemble sufficient hard power if it wants to be at the negotiating table with regard to the outcome in Ukraine, which is fundamental to security in Europe. So I don't see a situation in Ukraine where that conflict goes into a series of ceasefires or potential peace negotiations and so forth. All of that has a fundamental importance to the security in Europe. Because if Russia, if Vladimir Putin gets away with violating national sovereignty and territorial integrity in Ukraine, then, by the way, there are dozens of other other examples around the world where those two principles might be challenged, and Vladimir Putin won't be done with Ukraine. So I have confidence, but I would say guarded confidence, guarded optimism that Europe will come together. You know, something that was sort of overwhelmed by the J.D. Vance speech in Munich was he was preceded in the lineup that Friday by von der Leyen from the European Commission. And she stated clearly that she was going to pursue the lifting of the debt limits on EU member states so that they could, with the express purpose that they could use deficit spending if that spending were committed to increasing defense capabilities. That's significant. And that, I think, is another one of these signposts that we should watch. Is this actually enacted? And then do member states in the European community and the European Union, do they take advantage of it?
I agree with that being a hugely important signpost, but I do want to stick right now with some of the more urgent concerns with the support for Ukraine. And we don't know if the U.S. aid is fully stopped or what's going on. But, you know, traditionally speaking, when you're dealing with a very diverse European community, one reason right. that it's been easier for the U.S. to be the leader is because Americans aren't Europeans. They can lead these military alliances, and, you know, France isn't complaining about Germany taking too much credit. Germany's not complaining about the Brits taking too much credit. As this was all happening, I was thinking, well, who is the default leader of Europe now? And right. not only politically, but then the question was, who by default is the most capable of organizing a complex military operation? And I didn't know the answer to that. So putting on your general's hat and your NATO hat, I mean, some of these capabilities are difficult. Do the British, and I don't want to single out the British, but do the British have the organizational capabilities to put together a coalition of potential, I mean, this is long down the road, but a potential right. coalition of peacekeepers? Or is it really something only the U.S. can do?
Well, okay, so this goes to my point about the EU finding itself and assessing whether it will step up and be a global power center. And in particular, your question addresses the hard power dimension of global power. And I think it's an open question. There's no issue that there's no European country today that can simply step into a international coalition leadership role because they simply don't have the capacity. They don't have the command structures. They don't have the logistics capacity. They don't have the long reach and high-end enabling capacities like surveillance, air-to-air refueling, long-range precision fires, surveillance, reconnaissance, intelligence, and so forth, that the U.S. brings, right? And this is why this is so difficult right now for European leaders. There's a need for Europe to step up, especially given the now doubt cast on American leadership, but they don't have the capabilities. When we talk about a European coalition, this is not a coalition that can take advantage of the standing capabilities inside NATO. Right. So for NATO to take this role, the vote today would have to be 32-0. Right. So for NATO to stand up a military operation as it did in Afghanistan, for example, or as it did in the Balkans in the 90s. Right. The vote's got to be unanimous. So and the good news is if NATO is unanimous and steps up, it's got practiced, exercised, standing. I mean, those headquarters are in place today. And that's the value of NATO, right? Once NATO is divided east-west across the Atlantic with the doubts about American leadership, the Europeans are just going to fall short on a number of key military capabilities that would be required to lead such a coalition. Now, that's just the military hardware part, right? And this is knowable. I mean, we can compile, tabulate, inventory these military capabilities. Perhaps even more significant is your question about the political leadership of such a coalition. The value of NATO, again, is it has a standing political body. I mean, that's why there are permanent representatives to the North Atlantic Council. These are the 32 ambassadors who reside in NATO headquarters, right, and can convene on 20 minutes notice. A coalition has no such overarching political body and would have to be made up on an ad hoc basis. And then the question is, you know, who leads that political structure? There's no secretary general. And what political body equips, enables the military capability with guidance like rules of engagement, a mission statement, generating the resources required, and so forth. So the suggestions coming out of London this past weekend about a coalition of the willing and so forth are laudable in terms of ambition, but in my view, will very soon bump into hard political military realities that such coalitions, absent the U.S., such coalitions are probably not practical in the near term.
Staying within Europe, then, what does this mean for Ukraine's defense?
Well, so 3 years into this fight, we've moved a long way from where Ukraine was in at the beginning in 2022. So first of all, it's important for us, and perhaps especially Americans, to understand that Europe today has actually marshaled more assistance, both military assistance and other than military assistance, for Ukraine over the last 3 years than America has. That, and this gets wildly distorted. These numbers get wildly distorted in, you know, off-the-cuff comments in Washington. But the Kiel Institute, in my view, in Germany, is the sort of gold standard of keeping track of the ledger sheet, right, for assistance to Ukraine. And the numbers are pretty clear that Europe has already done more than the United States. And I think, given the dynamics over the last couple of weeks, that assistance from Europe will continue and perhaps even increase, right? So that's good news for Ukraine. The other thing that's changed in the last 3 years is that the Ukrainian defense industrial base has not only survived, it has matured. Last year, Ukraine built, for Ukraine, over 1 million drones. 1 million. I mean, there's no production like that anywhere else in the world. So Ukraine is producing for Ukraine. Estimates are about 30% of Ukrainian defense needs in terms of hardware. The real challenge for Ukraine today is not as much as it was several years ago, hardware, munitions, 155 millimeter artillery rounds, and that sort of thing. The hardware of warfare, but the manpower of warfare. And Ukraine has got to come to grips with, I believe, increased mobilization of its human resources to steady the battlefield. You know, it took Ukraine in the political arena over a year to approve an adjustment in the mobilization law that allowed mobilization from 27 years old to 25 years old. That took a year ago. They're still not mobilizing, drafting Ukrainians below that age. So, and there are national reasons for this. And by the way, this is a sovereign decision, right? I mean, Ukraine's fighting for its sovereignty. Well, here's a sovereign decision that's difficult to critique from the outside because Ukraine is a sovereign nation. But they've got to come to grips with that. So there's both external military assistance, the increased potential of Ukraine to produce for itself, and then the lingering problem, the persistent problem of Ukrainian manpower, that all come together to answer your question about how does this go forward.
So there's no reason for Europeans to hit the panic button on Ukrainian defense.
But correct.
That's good. That's positive.
And I would say, I mean, if we were assigned a timeline to that, I would say this year.
But but it has to happen. I mean,
Europe
needs to get its sort of aid structure and whatever sorted out.
Correct.
Soon, but we're not talking about a collapse of the front line in the next 6 months.
That's correct. And now that's also, I mean, you know, front line dynamics are always at least two way, right? And it is also coupled by the fact that the Ukrainians have caused such heavy attrition among the Russian forces. You know, estimates now are 750,000 or 800,000 Russian casualties. And the Russians that have been mobilized or pressed into service to occupy mostly the Donbas and Crimea in Ukraine are not fighting for national survival as the Ukrainians are. So there's a quality advantage here on the battlefield in favor of Ukraine. So we talked about quantitative measures, right? But there's a qualitative measure that gives me confidence in the Ukrainians to fight for their survival, to fight for their country with a motivated, well-led force, all relative to the similarly low-quality counterparts on the Russian side. So that gives me confidence through 2025.
Okay, so no need to hit the panic button on Ukraine. I do want to maybe end, though, by talking a little bit about another or the final pillar of U.S. foreign policy, which was our history of providing aid to people and countries in need. 40% of the world's humanitarian aid dollars come from the United States, which for those of us who are religious might be something that we can be proud of, that our taxpayer dollar has fed the hungry and cared for the sick. But the current administration has taken a hatchet to the U.S. Agency for International Development. And the argument here was that aid is not in America's self-interest. And I kind of wanted to get your sense of what you think about that. I mean, I would start by just reminding us that actually it is in the U.S. interest to stabilize conflict zones, to provide economic development to, say, even Central and South American countries, because if things go badly there, then we have migrant crises at the U.S. border, which
right.
you might say is an issue or not politically, but it's a thing. People move when there's no stability, and they move en masse. And we remember, of course, the Syrians fleeing to Europe in 2015 as well. So morally, you know, USAID is a good thing. How do you assess it being in the U.S. interest or not? And you have a lot of experience with this because you probably dealt with a lot of aid institutions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and maybe you still do.
Well, I mean, your four-pillar construct at the beginning of our conversation today, I think, is fundamentally sound. And one of those pillars is this development pillar. Look, I don't know anybody who's served in the U.S. federal government for more than, for a decade or two, right, who doesn't have personal observations that there's plenty of room for efficiencies, right? And there's plenty of room for reform. Because, look, not unlike the international organizations that we spoke about a few minutes ago, needing to reform or adapt and die. The same is true internally for American institutions. I mean, our Defense Department needs to reform, our State Department, our intelligence community, and our development agency. So this is not fundamentally about marshaling an argument that everything's okay. There is room, and I think necessity, to reform. The question is, do you go after this reform, in the case of U.S. aid, with a scalpel and with the facts in hand, or do you go after it with, you said hatchet, I would use chainsaw, and cause more damage than maybe you intended, or cause so much damage that you complicate the recovery process, right? I believe that the congressional and public support for development assistance and humanitarian assistance. Because remember, the second part of the mission statement for USAID is not only development assistance, but it's humanitarian in the face of natural disasters, for example, right? That those two functions will persist. They will survive this effort to take USAID apart. The question is, so what succeeds USAID? I believe there's a reasonable argument. And administrations of both parties, by the way, have over time considered merging again USAID with the State Department, right? And there's a certain logic to that. So you can imagine efficiencies and improved effectiveness because our diplomats are sitting right alongside our development professionals, right? And there's no bureaucratic agency boundary between the two, which slows things down and complicates coordination and sometimes has these two agencies working even perhaps unintentionally at odds, right? So there, you can imagine another model here. The challenge with the approach the Trump administration has taken is that with the wholesale layoffs, dismissing of 10, 20, 25-year administrators, the people who actually are in the engine room of USAID, who know this business, the development business, know the humanitarian assistance business, manage the accounts, have the texture, the, I'm going to get this wrong, but it's a German audience,
Fingerspitzengefühl. Sehr gut.
Andy, that's it. Okay, the texture, the fine understanding of these very critical functions, those people are now on the street. They've been laid off. So what brings them back into a role where they can meaningfully again contribute? And I'm not sure. I think the damage, the lasting damage here is not that these functions will disappear, but we've lost the manpower to make it.
Sure, but more broadly speaking, as a general, as a NATO ambassador, has your experience of these humanitarian or USAID involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan when you were right. in charge of those wars, was that making America's life easier? Was it making your life easier having the power to call on these agencies for help?
No question.
So I thought maybe you can give me example or two.
So both in Iraq and Afghanistan, which were fundamentally about two political challenges, right? To whom will the people of Iraq and Afghanistan pledge allegiance, right? To whom will they find common cause? Will it be the insurgents or will it be the standing government, right? And in that contest for the people, the population, perhaps much more than hard power, you know, killing insurgents or so forth, right? Perhaps much more important than what the military can do is what the people can gain from organizations like USAID. So when the allegiance of the population is the fundamental tension in a conflict, like it was in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you can argue it still is, we're just less present, right? Then development assistance can be critical because, you know, the well that produces clean drinking water, the agricultural assistance that improves crop production, the health assistance that reduces childhood disease, right, are all very, very meaningful when you're trying to win over a population. Development assistance in those sorts of conflicts are the perhaps the most powerful complement to military power. And quite candidly, Andy, if America learned anything in the first 5 to 10 years of the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, we relearned the lessons having to do with what we call cross-government or interagency cooperation, meaning that the military alone does not have the tools to get the job done. And if there is a prospect for success and progress in these sorts of conflicts, it has to come from our ability to coordinate the different tools of American and allied, in the case of Afghanistan, allied power that includes this lash-up between hard power and what you might refer to as soft power, so development and so forth. And look, part of the reason we struggle in both places, Iraq and Afghanistan, is that we were slow on the uptake here in terms of understanding the power of organizations like USAID, but also UNHCR, international organizations like UNHCR, UNDP, UNPA, the political development power of these other organizations. I think we, later in Iraq and Afghanistan, we matured, we had better appreciation, but this remains an incomplete task for America. And to this day, in American military, professional military education systems, and National Defense University, our war college systems, and so forth, this topic, the topic of your question, is very much a topic of study, because the Iraq and Afghanistan generation has been convinced in the school of hard knocks, in the school of practical experience on the ground in a conflict zone, of the power of having partners, bureaucratic partners like USAID, but figuring out how to work alongside them. So this is absolutely essential. And I think, candidly, the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan understand this better than most.
I have about 1,000 more questions about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we've run out of time. Thank you so much for that little overview, though. We've covered so much ground today. I really hope my audience learned a lot about different aspects of U.S. foreign policy going forward. Ambassador Liu, do you have any final message maybe to the people of Germany?
This may sound a little melodramatic, but don't give up on us. Look, America's going through a political transition as well. So we talked about the international transition and the world order and rules of the road and, you know, multipolar, unipolar, bipolar. Okay, we got all that. But America's going through some internal transition, and it's not settled out yet. So this is not locked in stone or written in stone in terms of how we will come out. Look, I live 2 miles from the White House in rural Virginia, outside Washington, D.C. I drive by the White House every day on my way to work. I remember for the 6 years that I worked there that every single day that I walked beneath the awning and into the main entrance of the West Wing, what an incredible privilege it was to serve. And I believe there are people like that today. And I also believe in the power of our Constitution that sets up Congress as a check and balance against overreach in the executive branch. That relationship, Congress to the executive branch, is under stress right now. Behind that balance is our court system. So this is not a done deal with regard to Washington and the White House. And I believe America has demonstrated over 220 some years, whatever it's been now, its ability to adapt. And I believe we will adapt again. So to my German friends, to my NATO allies, the message I think is take a deep breath. We've all got to account for new situations. There are things that need to be done. Let's roll up our sleeves and do them, but don't count one another out.
Fine words to end. Ambassador Lute, thank you so much for joining me, and everyone, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously,
Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americancentrum.de. Thanks for listening.